I, Libertine, Chapter 8. Featherfront was a wood, a brook, a house, a byre rebuilt into a carriage house, the foundations of a burnt barn, a stable with servants' quarters in a second story, and a state of mind. The state of mind may have been a product of the spring that year, which was remarkable, even for England, even for the North Downs. It may have been a magic, such as they say lies over houses built too close to running water and old woods where the little folk have not yet been driven away. Or the new population of the house may have been sufficient to account for it. It was mad, mysterious, hilarious, indecent, joyful, and studious. In an ell very nearly as tall as the main part of the house, Evelyn Meadows established his laboratory. The peaked roof bore a particularly silly cupola, and this they had stilted up and had knocked out a smoke hole under it, affording an escape for the fumes and vapors without which alchemy seemed such a sham. There were book racks and lecterns and inkhorns ranged on two sides of the room. On the third, racks and shelves of chemicals, ores, metal specimens, rhinoceros and narwhal horns, toad skins and other raw materials of the paraceltic art. The fourth wall was devoted to the tools of the trade, an alembic, rows of flasks, beakers, retorts, and graduates, scales, and, of all things, an astrolabe. This wall was divided by a monstrous fireplace, not quite high enough to walk in upright, but wide enough to spit an ox. Despite Lance's offer to put up the equipment and supplies, Meadows' collection had been almost completely sufficient for the purpose. Indeed, his lodging had not sufficed for all of it. He had had a second flat in London from which his hobby had crowded him, and which he had been using for some time exclusively for storage. In so haphazard a manner had this clutter been accumulated that Meadows himself was astonished and delighted at its richness and variety. He had things that he had not only forgotten about, but things he would say he had wished for all his life. Owl droppings he had, cantharides, and swordfish teeth, flakes of rust from one of the holy nails, a brace of otherwise empty flagons each containing the dying breath of a hanged man, picklings of a blue rat, a whale's eye, an arctic mouse, a child's hand, an unborn stoat, an unidentified object with abscesses. The main part of the house formed a shell around what was almost a single room, a great hall with a fireplace at each end, and a row of rooms along the north wall, so designed that their ceilings formed a balcony for the hall. One end of this balcony was closed to form yet another room, and its separate staircase leading by a covered way to the kitchens at the rear. After swearing Meadows to fealty in silence, Lance confessed to him that there dwelt in the upstairs room a part of his past too shameful to describe and too painful to discuss. Meadows took the revelation as a weighty compliment, and respected the confidence devoutly, his sole reference to it a worshipful expression when Lance would sigh, grim-faced, and mount the covered stairs and closet himself with the mystery.
"Brave chap that, Courtney,"
he would mutter over his fuming sulphurs. The shameful, painful secret was, of course, Verabridge. At long last separated from his noisome Bermondsey, and ensconced here like a spectre in a castle, he was served and cared for by a mute, ox-shouldered young woman acquired with the property. She could hear well enough and understand tolerably. Verabridge was on splendid terms with her, and because she was obedient, and because she listened to him. The days fell into a shambling order. If Lance missed skimming like a bat at eventide into the margins of high society, he did not show it. Meadows was in seventh heaven. He produced elixirs and effluvia, precipitates, ash, conglomerates, and stinks, and theories. he hummed and droned with theories. Phlogiston and the soul of Mercury, the Aristotelian quadrant, and its dissimilarities to the tetronomy of Vincent of Beauvais, and on and on and on. It was pleasant, after a time, in the long evenings when he did not feel like chatting with Barrowbridge, nor walking on the downs. He could nod by the fire and listen to the excited drones of Meadows' voice, repeating a name or a Latin phrase every 12 or so minutes, just enough to keep Meadows primed and pumping. Meadows was happy. Meadows was more than happy. Lance had never seen a man more capable of creating a world for himself as he wanted it, and living in it wholly. Any evidence to the contrary could be forgotten as soon as seen. He was no longer a student. He was an alchemist. He did not pretend to be a master, but he felt he would be, as soon as he made his great discovery. Great discoveries care not who makes them. Meadows was in tune with this, being a great discoverer who cared not what discoveries he made. He mixed messes and heated them, made infusions and rubbed them on a cat. With long forceps he lifted smoking lumps from his fires and held them hopefully against silver, then against lead, and tested the lead with his heart beating wildly. Always was he disappointed, but never dashed. With all this happiness it was obvious, painfully so, that his greatest happiness lay in Lance. Lance's ear, Lance's presence, Lance's opinions. Lance required little, but short of leaving one of his experiments at the explosion point, Meadows did his utmost to anticipate anything Lance might want. Lance would return from a stroll on the downs to find the fire laid in the living room, his pipe filled and waiting, and more often than not some tome on transmutation or the noble airs awaiting beside it. This would surely be the subject of today's efforts. At the first sound of his step at the door, Meadows, bearing a flaming coal from one of his cauldrons, would come bounding like a meteor across the great hall to start Lance's fire, trailing sparks and smoke and observations.
"Who cares about phlogiston? I've found a heavy air that won't burn. If phlogiston is life, then this is death."
Or,
"It burns, it burns!"
Which would mean that Lance had to sprint into the laboratory to help him save the building from the flames, or run to the goods chest for a salve for his blisters, or rush to the pantry for milk for him to drink and quench the interior fire, for Meadows was scientist enough to insist upon trying out the elixirs that he made in the most direct way. Lance quickly became aware that he was not another happiness for Meadows. He was the happiness. Meadows neither hugged him nor fell at his feet. He had no need to. When a man has a preoccupation as profound as Meadows in his alchemy, and yet will permit any interruption, any change of subject from someone, he obviously values the someone above the preoccupation. Meadows shared his alchemy not so much because of Lance's stated conviction that he too was interested, but because Lance was key to it, part of the pattern of his absorption. Lance spoke of it to Barrowbridge.
"Not that I mind terribly. I picture myself racking my brains for ways and means to keep the idiot content. I thought I might even have to drug him or lock him in. I never dreamed I'd simply have to loose him like a ruddy falcon and have him eating out of my hand."
"You might have known,"
Barrowbridge chuckled. Within a week, he had settled in at Featherfront, Lance's second great surprise, for at the outset he had fumed and wept and cursed most bitterly. Getting him down by coach and up those stairs had been a mountainous undertaking, and for 2 days after he had glowered out the window and complained that a body couldn't get a wink of sleep without so much as a muscle-monger crying outside the window. The fresh air made him cough. The fresh food sat ill in his jaded stomach, and there wasn't anything to do. These, it appeared, were protests which he felt duty-bound to release. And once cathartized, he was done with them. His flesh seemed firmer, and part of his voice had returned. He slept a sinful amount, 10 to 12 hours out of 24, and spent the rest of the time jollying Johnson, the heavy-shouldered mute girl, and reading. His room was three times as large as the one in Bermondsey. He had all his books and more besides. Lance, having been fully aware that some new ones would help him lick into the new place, as one puts butter on the paws of a cat in a new environment, that it may lie and contemplate while removing it, he had insisted upon paying his own way, and a bit over, and with a minimum of grumbling, though, as ever, he hoarded the secret of his total resources, whatever they may be. And so he acclimated and throve. He had his bed, his great chair, his stick, and his thoughts, and enough conversation to suit him, and, as a bonus, a gimlet hole in the wall which faced the great hall. Thereby he could keep track of events below. This delighted him more than a window might have done. He was thoroughly conversant with the worshipful capers of Evelyn Meadows, and said, "You should have known," to Lance.
"Known? Known what? How?"
"Did you not spend the better time of 3 days haunting his haunts and gossiping with his gossips?"
"Aye, but it was his alchemical pursuits I was interested in. Once I found out about them, I found them first."
"You learned nothing else?"
"Only what I already knew."
Betteridge wagged his big old head. "Ah, lad, lad, I told ye, when reading for law, and the use of a law, never to stop with the law which concerns you, but to read all around it, before it, behind it, everything like it, and all that echoes it. I think in law you have learned that, but you've forgotten to apply it elsewhere."
"What did I miss, then?"
"Why, that young specimen was sent down from Christ's Hospital."
"I didn't know he went to school there. Why?"
"He's got a passion for a housemaster, that's why, and he couldn't conceal it. 'Cause what he was sent down for was not concealing it. That's the way the world wags."
"Betteridge! I never dreamed he was one of those. I mean, I've seen dozens of them mincing about, of course, but Meadows? He doesn't look the least."
"You've seen pimps and panderers and lechers, wife-beaters and catamites, time without number. If you haven't recognized some of them as such, it's because you're purblind and wishful. As a lawyer, you should know better. As a gentleman, you should be aware of what to avoid publicly." Again he committed that harrowing laugh. "Don't look so stricken, Lanky. He's a nice enough lad, our Meadows. Balmy, of course, but only because his hobbies are unfashionable. The one would have made him valuable at the time of Roger Bacon, the other popular at the time of Plato."
"What on earth am I to do?"
Lance demanded, in a voice approaching a bleat of panic. "Nay, nay," soothed the barrister. "Don't let it trouble you, not a bit. He'll make no excursions on you and your little white body, I'll wager. Can't you see that what he's doing is searching for his special grail instead? He doesn't want his discovery just for himself. He wants to honor you with it. There's an old saying. I'd appreciate your committing it to memory, Lanky. 'Tisn't Gracie in this time, it's Chinese. This is it. A cat that's once stepped on a hot stove will never step on a cold one. Meadows has never lived down the public humiliation his openness and honesty got for him at Christ's College. He'll never make the same mistake again."
"Damn it," said Lance irritably. "All this while you haven't understood a thing about how I feel. I'm not afraid of anything he might do, for God's sake. I'm thinking about what they'll be saying in town."
"Eh?"
"You haven't heard those young bloods chat after dinner?"
"I have.
They gossip worse than seamstresses. If one of the chaps is larking about with a woman, it's like a ruddy game. One point for each level of society higher than you. An extra point if she's pure or married. If she's beneath you, you forfeit points accordingly. If you're caught, you lose all your accumulated reputation and forfeit about 10. You'd have to seduce a countess or better to make up for it.
Poins? Good heavens, not really.
No, of course not. I'm just trying to explain to you what it's like. Now a thing like this Meadows business, why, it can cling to a man all his life. I've seen it happen. And the worst is, once a thing like this gets about, the poor victim never hears about it himself. I've seen chaps lose appointments, fail in betrothal arrangements, lose elections because of a buzz like this, and all behind a man's back. Mr. Barrowbridge, I cannot afford anything like this.
He struck his forehead suddenly.
My God, Lilith Axelrod's laughing already, laughing right in my face about this.
Eh? Now you see, before you a penalty of understanding which breeds tolerance, which overlooks danger. You're right, lad, you're quite right. Has Meadows told anyone where he is? What? No matter. He will. Poor tilted innocent. He will. Never thinking he might harm his benefactor.
The benefactor got up and took a turn around the room.
I cannot go back to town yet, nor send him. If I went somewhere else... No, I don't think Mr. Beasley would care for that much. It would be pointless unless I were seen talking to people. I don't want to disturb matters just now. Dash it all, sir, what can I do?
Not for the first time, nor the hundredth, Barrowbridge said.
There's a way out, lad. A way out. All we have to do is think of it.
So they thought, and they thought. And suddenly, Barrowbridge brought his hand down on his meaty thigh.
I've got it!
What, sir, what?
You've got to get involved in a scandal.
A scandal?
Well, we must most judiciously choose this scandal,
said Barrowbridge pensively.
Now, lad, identify, delineate.
I don't see how a scandal...
Don't you, though? Some escapade designed to get back to London before any silly story about Meadows being here. Some adventure vivid enough to be talked about, natural enough to underline your acceptable appetites, yet harmless enough to do you no discredit in the future.
But that second black won't make a white, sir.
Ah, it will here. You'll find that one of the outstanding characteristics of vice is its specialization. Your sot who drinks himself into the ground does it generally with a single liquor, the wine-head eschewing brandy, and the brandy-bucko scorning wine. Let it be known as a party to some scandal involving a woman, and your gossips will have a choice of narratives about you. But a choice, Lanky. One, not both.
But how can we know which they'll tell?
Lance virtually wailed. Barrowbridge pulled his nether lip.
It is that element which calls for the judiciousness of our choice. We must present you as a rake, not a defiler. Libertine rather than lecher.
Libertine? I?
Men have made greater sacrifices for king, country, and career,
said the old man dryly.
And how on earth am I to find just the proper scandal?
Manufacture it, lad. I do think that with careful application of the reductio, we might deduce an ideal, and then devise a path to it between the high walls of our limitations.
You treat it like an exercise upon the chessboard.
Aye, and therein lies our greatest chance of success. When the sage of Tarragona said, every onset of passion is a digression from rational conduct, he was speaking of anger. But taking passion at its word, we find ourselves with a prime coloration for our problem. Let it be throughout a course of rational, that is, reasoned conduct. It will be to the public eye
an act of passion. In passion, as in wine, there is truth. In his cups and on his couch, a man reveals himself more than in the confessional, which is by no means as conducive to revelation. Whatever you reveal in this act, then, will be publicly regarded as the truth about you. See to it that reason does not desert you during the performance. For the time being, treat your animal aptitudes not as allies, but as enemies, remembering that a wise man gets more use from his enemies than a fool from his friends.
Lance bowed his head and opened his very paws to the old man's counsel. Many times before he had seen Bearabridge at work on a problem in just this fashion, discursive, preparatory, dripping aphorisms and homiletics, and while circling his problem, even while passing and repassing openings to it, which later he might use, spiraling relentlessly nearer, the arrival at the heart of the problem, while delayed, was inevitable. The problem by then would be far more familiar than formidable.
I knew an old sinner in Somerset who had a single genius. He carved little bears out of wood. I asked him how he did it, and he said, "I like it wood until I see bruin, then I uncover and chip it off." This should be our approach. Let us uncover away all that is superfluous, and we shall be left with what we can use. Let us eliminate all that might discredit you, the degrading, the disgusting, the perverse, the ludicrous. I amend that. An element of the ludicrous might be a desideratum, provided that it is not yourself who suffers from it. We want, after all, a story worth telling. A touch of the ridiculous is like woodruff in sweet rhine. Let us eliminate that which might offend the majority and any powerful minority. The partner in your venture must be unconnected with royalty, the church, or the higher nobility. She must not be excessively tender in her years, because that's felonious, nor excessively aged, for that would discredit you. She must not be beneath you, for the narrative would then be of no moment. Should she be your peer, there is nothing to be gained from that circumstance alone, and the other factors in the interchange must supply the unusual. It would seem, then, that she must be someone of good, but not powerful family, of high but not exalted station, of an age in no way unsuited to such activities, and above all, in no position to prolong matters one moment longer than it takes to create the scandal.
Incredible, murmured Lance devoutly.
Don't interrupt, boy,
said Bearabridge, who was never happier than at moments like this.
So much for the heroine, now the occasion. It should not be too forceful, lest you find yourself vying for honours with a mere-blooded bull. It should not be too abrupt, lest in the telling you raced with the rabbit. It must seem that she, not you, created the opportunity, and that you, not she, commanded its consummation. It is the function of a man to yield to his desires, and the duty of a gentleman to yield to his ladies. The art of seduction then lies in turning these currents into the same channel, and making them confluent and synonymous. From this we derive that on this occasion you must clearly perform both function and duty, this being the entire purpose of our enterprise, the very coda of the legend we are creating. Now we can see the goal and the limitations, and that the latter are, as I have said, walls flanking the course, and not obstacles. Your route should be all the more direct for that, which brings up the last requisite and completes the picture.
Speed.
Quod erat demonstratum, Lanky, and I'd suggest you proceed with dispatch and without procrastination.
What would I do without you?
Lance cried.
Do without, I imagine. I'm glad you can do with, though. I'll confess, who was it turned the human brain a wrinkled jelly? Skeffington? Richardson? No matter. But it's a splendid description of what your friend Barrowbridge has become. Let me lie here, shivering totally with all subtle movements, shielded by the carapace of your house, nourished by the sanguinary fluxions of our good mute Johnson up and down the artery of my covered stair. Let me lie here, I say, white matter and grey supplying the total organization pulselessly with mysteries, conjectures, solutions, and escapes. Let me know what happens, Lanky.
That I will, sir, and thank you.
Beside Lance's brook at Featherfront ran a bridle path. A mile or so downstream it met the little road between Titsey and Tatsfield. The other way, 3 miles or so, would bring a rider to Sir Gregory Eustace's holding. It might be called a manse, considering the land he owned, which, though fit only for goats and bark-browsing deer, was considerable in extent. Indeed, it began at the margin of the Featherfront property, which had been a part of Sir Gregory's land. Sir Gregory called his estate Minden, after the battle which perpetuated itself in his memory, because it was there he had by mistake achieved his baronetcy, having become hopelessly lost with a contingent of light horse, and emerging suddenly from a defile, had inadvertently pierced and broken the French lines, and started that famous route. He was a widower, a very owl of a little man, with sharp ears, huge eyes, and a little hooked beak, and he lived with a sizable staff of servants, 3 daughters, their governess, a genteel spinster named Callow, a small hunting stable, and some dogs. His library was admirable, and his chief occupation was a prodigious combing of it, and making of endless notes, it being his ambition to write the biography of the City of the Seven Hills, from the whelping of the Wolf of Romulus to the death of the 13th Clement. Since the purchase of Featherfront, Lance had made it a point to ride or walk up to Minden from time to time. It was a pleasant walk, with a glass of good sack at the end of it. It was a source of London news and talk, for Sir Gregory went up for a day or so each fortnight, and it was now. Dutifully precepted by Barrowbridge, Lance left no possibility unexamined. What might have been an embarrassment of riches in his search for a partner in scandal became a most methodical manner after his talk with the old man. There was an upstairs maid, for example, a veritable queen among females, a creature of light who could be summarily dismissed because of the elimination of the lower orders. He was saved cogitation upon Barbara and Bella Eustace, their likes, dislikes, and potential weaknesses, because of the dictum about ages. They were 8 and 10 years old, respectively. He did not know how old Elaine, the elder daughter, was, and he would not ask. She was past 13, which was what was important. The only other female of high enough stature, who also fell within the natural activity statute, was Hepzibah Callow, the governess. Miss Callow had a classical education, extraordinarily perfect diction, and skin trouble. Her father, he heard, had been an Irish army officer, which seemed on the face of it to present little altitude, until one recalled that the Gunning sisters and Miss Chudley herself came from similar sources. It would seem that the daughters of Irish officers floated free in the social structure, rather like literary men in their educators. One might never solidly place them as not gentry, just as merchant baronets and musicians could never quite be called gentlefolk. Miss Callow, then, and Elaine Eustace. Elaine was totally subject to her father's control in speech and movement, but the silent net of his discipline could not contain her vibrancy, which escaped in little vivid flashes of teeth, of eyes, of wit, and wistfulness. Her hair was gold and red in the sun, red and gold by the fire. She seldom looked up at anything which interested her, really interested her. It was as if she were afraid she could not contain herself if she opened her eyes. So she would peep between lowered lashes like some bright bird turning and turning its head behind bars. On the other hand, there was the warning about involvements during and involvements after. So then, Miss Callow? Oh dear, he thought, Miss Callow. He bade farewell at the conclusion of this most casual of calls, and walked home in deep thought. He wanted to go straight to Barrowbridge, and found his patience not broken, but badly bent at having to negotiate a particularly ardent attack of Meadows. This time it was not as he entered, but before, while crossing the footbridge to his land. Meadows burst out of the house, half mad with exhaustion and enthusiasm. He had for 3 days and nights been gobbling the dim contents of old books, and slaving over his bubbling messes. "Paracelsus!" he piped from 100 feet, capering and galloping across the bowling green. "My dear chap, I can't tell you. I shall. Almost as an afterthought, he resumed breathing for a time, clutching both fists tight under his heart, while fixing Lance with eyes so deep-set and far away that they seemed part of some other place, like animals peering from a distant wood. "Paracelsus! I've discovered Paracelsus! I've read him and read him! Read of him, I mean to say, and all that!" He breathed again painfully and shrilly, and then took Lance's left bicep in his hands, kneading as he towed the young man along. "And I never knew what he meant!"
"What did he mean?"
Lance asked laboriously.
"Nonsense!"
cried Meadows, so abruptly that Lance shied like a colt, and Meadows almost left the ground.
"I mean it's nonsense about the Philosopher's Stone, transmutation and all that. No, not that. I mean, I believe it can be done, but what's nonsense is that transmutation is what alchemy is for. It's jolly well, isn't it, I mean to say."
He blathered and paused to wipe spittle from the corners of his lips with his shoulder.
"Alchemy is what Paracelsus said was for making medicines. Alchemy," he orated, loosing one of his hands to help him, "is chemistry, and chemistry is medicine. Alchemy is medicine, you see. What, what? My dear, dear chap,"
he said, replacing the elocutionary hand a split second before Lance could free himself and beginning to knead again.
"It's a revelation! Bringing the sick! Bring me the maimed!"
"My dear, dear chap,"
said Lance, unable to keep himself from vicious mimicry,
"don't you think you ought to get some sleep?"
"Sleep? Sleep at a time like this? I'll never sleep again. Yes, thank you, thank you. That's what I shall do first. An elixir to banish sleep. You know what you've done?"
he squeaked, incredibly adding another wave of excitement to his hysteria.
"You've given me a score of years, just by a wave of your mind, of your hand. For if we sleep a third of each day, we sleep a third of our life, and if a life's 80 years, we're dead and useless a third of it, sleeping. I owe you 20 years for your inspiration, Lance. I shall pay it, I shall pay it."
At last he loosed his host and went toward the laboratory wing at a dead run. Lance stood watching the thin, ungainly, flapping figure, crossing the green, crossing the Pall Mall Court, catching his foot in a wicket, which pulled out, but which also tilted the flying alchemist forward at a 45-degree angle. He increased his pace and maintained a dynamic equilibrium at that angle for a full 30 yards, running faster and faster until his outstretched hands slammed him into the side of the building, and his head immediately following, though not nearly so hard. Lance saw it rebound, and then Meadows pressed the building away from him, like the good Lord setting aside Satan, turned and weaved toward the door. Lance rubbed a while at his compressed biceps, and suddenly shuddered briefly, but quite as violently as a wet dog. He entered the great hall, and quietly crossed to the inside door to the lab and peered through. Evelyn Meadows was crumpled on a wooden bench, his right hand extended toward a stirring rod, and an expression of ineffable peace on his dirty face. He was fast asleep. Lance sighed and went to the storage for a light blanket, which he brought back and spread over the slumberer. Softly, softly, like a nurse soothing the troubled slumber of a sick child, Lance whispered,
"Wretched, unnatural swine, why didn't you tell me?"
He plodded up the covered stairs to Barrowbridge.
"Mr. Barrowbridge," he said wearily, "what a governess do you